Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. If you're into history, particularly Tudor history, you're in for a special treat today, as I'm really pleased to welcome back Tony Riches. Tony is a UK best-selling author of Tudor historical fiction and is a specialist in the lives of the early Tudors. As well as his new Elizabethan series, Tony's historical fiction novels include the best-selling Tudor trilogy and his Brandon trilogy about Charles Brandon and his wives. In an earlier episode, we discussed Tony's writing process and his selection of books. And I'll leave a link in the show notes so you can go back to that show. And today we're going to talk about his latest book, Penelope, which I'm currently reading and really enjoying. Penelope, Tudor Baroness, which is book four of the Elizabethan series. Hi, Tony, and welcome to the show, or welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me back again.
I was looking at the notes. It's about 3 years since we last spoke.
I can't believe it. Must be some mistake.
So how many books have you brought out since then, Tony?
Well, I write one book a year. So I think I mentioned before that my process works really well because I do my research in the summer, visiting actual locations and tracking down primary sources. And then I write in the winter and have a short break for Christmas. And then I edit in the spring so that normally the book comes out sort of May or June time, and the whole process starts all over again.
It sounds like a finely oiled machine.
It has. It's become that. And people say, when's the last book going to be? I'm actually planning about three books ahead.
Are you? Yeah. I guess there's so much content in the Tudor period. Well, and the Elizabethan period.
What's great is that there are so many people like Penelope that that I knew very little about. So I certainly don't remember ever being mentioned when I was at school doing history. And so it's fascinating for me to put more meat on the bones of the stories that I do know.
Just for those people who haven't yet listened to the earlier episode, Tony, please, can you give us a brief outline of your life's journey and how you became an author?
Yeah, well, I had a great career in the Royal Air Force, and then I joined the newly privatised British Gas, and then I moved on to the health service, and I was a director of the health service for a few years before I moved into management consultancy. And throughout that time, I used to write magazine articles as a bit of a hobby, really.
Yeah.
And my wife was always saying to me, I really should write about the Tudors, because I was born in Pembroke, which is where, of course, Henry Tudor was born, the first Tudor king. And I started researching his life and realized I had enough material for at least three books, which is how the Tudor trilogy was born, because I had him born in the first book, coming of age in the second, and becoming king in the third. And I'm really pleased to say that anybody that's thinking about writing a book, the first book became number one on Amazon in America and Australia and the UK.
Yeah.
So I had to give up work, really, and become a full-time author.
That must have been a great feeling. I bet you had to pinch yourself, didn't you, on that first?
I had to pay a massive tax bill because I wasn't geared up for it. I was already on higher rate tax.
Yeah.
And in the UK, you know, you're talking about nearly half of your income going to the government.
Yeah.
Luckily, they use it wisely.
Of course.
No, so I became a full-time author, and I've never looked back, quite honestly. And I live by the sea in Pembrokeshire, not far from where I was born. And I enjoy sailing and kayaking, so it's a perfect place to live and write.
Yeah. Okay, so talking about the new book, Penelope. And I know you set out to tell the story of the Tudor. So how does your new book, Penelope, Tudor Baroness, fit into the narrative?
Well, it's funny because when I started out, I was only thinking about the Tudor trilogy and the Henry VII becoming king. And then I realised that I could continue the story right through to the death of Elizabeth I. And she's such a complex character. I decided to tell her story through an Elizabethan trilogy where I took three of her favourites, which was Drake, Essex, and Raleigh, each of them saw her very differently because Drake worshipped her like a goddess, and Essex treated her like his mother, and Raleigh, of course, was captain of her guard. But then I wanted to show another side of her, and I decided to the rest of the series would be three books by three of her ladies. And so I'm now researching the second of her ladies. So the fourth book in the series is Penelope, and they're kind of in date order. So anybody reading the whole of the Elizabethan series will follow it through in a kind of logical timeline.
Yeah. And what process do you use for your research, Tony?
Well, I'll let you into a secret.
Please.
There's a website called Folgopedia, the Elizabethan Court Day by Day, which is absolutely fascinating and is full of these little details which mean so much to anybody writing about the period. For example, I was just researching about my new character's involvement in the Spanish Armada, and Elizabeth was resistant to calls to take it more seriously, the threat from Spain. She was still negotiating for peace. And then they had a shoal of porpoises swim up the Thames to Greenwich Palace.
Oh, yeah.
And they took it as an omen that could have been a fleet of Spanish ships.
Yes.
And I got all of that from Folgopedia, from the Elizabethan Court Day by Day, but it actually tells you what day it was and who saw it and where it's recorded. So it's really a brilliant source. But also, of course, I've been immersed in the Elizabethans for the last 4 years. And the second book in the series was about Penelope's brother, Robert Devereux. So I already knew quite a lot about her life and times, but from his perspective.
Yes.
And so that's the big difference, is it's fascinating to look at it from the other side of the coin.
Yeah, yeah. And the bit about where her mother was banished from the court, how was Penelope affected?
Well, people are probably aware of the long-term liaison between the Queen and a chap called Robert Dudley.
Yes.
And the worst thing that Penelope's mother could have done would be to lure him away and marry him in secret. She was lucky not to get executed for that, but she was banished from court forever. And you would have imagined that would have meant that Penelope would also be banished from court, but quite the reverse, because Elizabeth, in her rather strange view of the world, wanted to be a better mother for Penelope than her own mother had been. So Penelope was groomed from a young age to become a maid of honour for the Queen.
Yes. And what would the day-to-day life be like as maid of honour for Queen Elizabeth?
That was really interesting to research, because there's what it was supposed to be and what it actually was. So what it was supposed to be were these beautiful young virginal women, all dressed in white, surrounding the Queen, and the theory was that she would reflect their virtue and beauty, and any visitors that came would see her like a jewel amongst all these diamonds.
Yes.
And the reality of it was that they lived in a communal chambers, and of course it was gossip central, because they were all young eligible women looking for suitable husbands. Most of them were fairly well off. They came from noble families, like Penelope herself, was that her father was, you know, highly regarded, and so there wasn't much family money, but he was an earl, so she was expected to probably marry somebody quite high up. And of course, it went horribly wrong, because the court moved around often, And that created all these opportunities for the maids of honour, because they would often, there'd be nowhere for them to sleep. So they'd be shoved up in an attic somewhere of somebody's house while the court was on progress. Yeah. And that created lots of opportunities for goings on. And several of them actually became pregnant and were banished in disgrace. Oh, right. That's the kind of world that Penelope absolutely thrived in.
Yes.
Because she'd been not brainwashed, but coached for it all of her life. So she was well prepared as you could possibly be.
Yeah, you mentioned there about the court moving around a lot. And I have to say, you know, in my experience of watching the TV programs and reading, they always seem to be on the move.
Yeah, there's good reason for it. It's because the palaces, firstly, a lot of them were falling apart and needed a lot of maintenance.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the Queen didn't want people hammering away and replastering the walls while she was around. And secondly, they had the constant threat of plague. They didn't understand where the plague came from. And even today, we're still debating whether it was carried by fleas or whatever. But it suited them to be one step ahead of any outbreaks of plague,
yeah.
But also to abandon somewhere like Richmond Palace, which we must remember was originally the home of Henry VII, so it hadn't had a lot of work done on it since then. And they would take everything with them, all their beds and bedding and everything, which probably were infested with fleas anyway, while the workmen moved in and painted all the walls and put new tapestries up and stuff like that.
So it was practical reasons rather than sort of showing their power as they travel around the country?
Both, because what a wonderful way to remind people to see this magnificent procession of hundreds of knights on horseback and servants and the Queen herself, perhaps sometimes in a royal barge gilded. And the trouble was that the people they used to visit, even Robert Dudley nearly bankrupted himself getting Sudley Castle suitable for a royal visit.
Yeah.
And Penelope's experience of it was as one of the party travelling around from place to place.
Her father's choice of husband for her was Philip Sidney, and she became the inspiration for Stella in his sonnet sequence, Astrophel and Stella. So what happened?
Yeah, it's very sad that Philip Sidney, I kind of admire him, and they all did, by the way. He was the most eligible bachelor at court, and he was one of these people, I don't know who I'd compare him with today, but he could take on all comers at the joust, but at the same time he could write sonnets, which are still quoted from today. So that's quite an achievement, isn't it? And he was quite a handsome, easygoing chap. But what he didn't have was his own fortune. If you look into the history of the Sidneys, they made and lost fortune several times. And what he hoped to do was to inherit the fortune of Robert Dudley, including the title and all the estates, which brought in a great income from tenants. And sadly for him, the timing was awful, because Robert Dudley had a son with Penelope's mother who he called Robert Dudley, imaginatively. So he straight away he had an heir, and Philip would inherit nothing. So that meant that he couldn't ask Penelope to marry him, and he no longer became the hot prospect that he would have been.
Yeah.
Some people might know, sadly, the young Robert Dudley, who was nicknamed the Noble Imp, he died at a young age anyway, but it was all too late for poor Philip by then, because he had missed the chance.
Yeah. No, it's a sad part of the story, really. It sort of goes through, doesn't it? And it's interesting when you mentioned about his character. I noted that when the royal family took part in the slaying of the stags, he made a comment about it being not really the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I didn't want people to think that everybody was up for that any more than they are today, in that, you know, the population is divided, isn't it, between those that think blood sports are a great British tradition and those that don't.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's interesting.
Do you notice how I didn't give my own views on that at all then?
Not at all, no. You have to remain impartial, I guess, as an
author. Absolutely.
So, yeah, Baron Robert Rich, I must admit, he does seem an unlikely choice of husband for Penelope.
Dear.
Why did they marry?
I don't know if you remember, I don't know if it was in the Tudors, it's a while since I saw it, but he's a direct descendant from Richard Rich, who was Henry VIII's henchman. And so he was a villain, and that's where the, ironically, rich by name and rich by nature, because the reward for Richard Rich was to have huge fortunes from the dissolution of the monasteries. So that's where the money came from. And Robert Rich did very little, really, to earn his money, because he inherited it all. And he also inherited Lees Priory in Kent and a fortune. And from Robert Dudley's point of view, he was the perfect husband for his annoying little stepdaughter, Penelope.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was all about money. Penelope didn't have any say in it at all. But that's what they all knew and expected. It's the way it worked.
Yeah. So in 16th century England, the option of divorce, as we now understand it, didn't exist. So what did she do?
Well, there was one way of getting a divorce, but it's a little bit complicated because you actually had to get an Act of Parliament. And her husband was an MP, and he was never going to have the shame and indignity of it being debated in Parliament, whether he'd been such a bad husband, his wife wanted to get rid of him. So the only option really is either to put up with it, shut up and put up, or to agree some kind of deal. And that's exactly what happened, because Robert Rich had a son and heir by Penelope, and that was obviously where he saw his fortune going in the future. And so they managed to do a deal whereby she would not publicly humiliate him, and she would continue to be a baroness and to have an allowance, but she didn't have to live with him anymore.
Yeah, so it worked.
Well, after a fashion, but it's a bit unsatisfactory, isn't it, for all concerned? And one of the things that surprised me about the Elizabethans is that they understood in a very modern way, just as now, I shan't say you, but if a friend separated from his wife and lived with somebody else, it might raise an eyebrow in some quarters, but most people would understand that there was a jolly good reason for it. It's not the sort of thing you do on a whim, is it?
No.
And it was just the same in Elizabethan times. That all changed after the death of Elizabeth, because King James had very strict views about all of this. But by then, Penelope had already had her chance, sort of thing.
Yeah. And then moving on to her brother, her brother accused her of encouraging his rebellion. But why would he do this, and what actually happened?
I've got a theory about Robert Devereux, her younger brother, who I tried to hint at it in the book, but I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of emotional intelligence, but basically he was a very poor judge of other people's emotional responses to whatever he did, including the Queen, and was forever making gaffes and misreading the situation. And we must remember that he was in the Tower of London under sentence of execution, and he would cast around blaming anybody he could think of other than himself for his actions. He blamed his friends, he blamed his sister, anybody that he could list, really. And I can kind of understand that, because he was a desperate man by then. But Penelope had a huge influence over him, And there's an interesting question here as to why didn't she stop him? And part of the answer is she never thought it would go quite so far as it did, with him storming the gates kind of thing, you know?
Yes.
She thought it would be a grand gesture marching down the street with a load of armed Welshmen and give people like Robert Cecil something to think about, that he could raise an army in days and threaten the state, and they should jolly well take him more seriously. But the other thing about Penelope was she was in secret correspondence with James of Scotland, telling him that he had friends in London and that they wanted him to succeed Queen Elizabeth. And when he did, he could look to his friends for support and guidance. And so that's a dangerous thing to be doing. But that's what Penelope was up to.
Yes. Right. Okay. And, you know, after her brother was executed, what was her relationship? What was her relationship like with the Queen?
Well, non-existent, really. That I can imagine that they deeply distrusted each other. The Queen was said to be full of remorse after Robert Devereux was executed.
Oh, was she?
But I couldn't find any actual evidence of that. And there's this anecdotal story of a ring that she'd given him, and she said for him to return the ring if she ever needed him and she would know that it was from him.
Yeah.
And that he returned the ring, but she ignored it because she didn't actually receive it. Somebody intercepted it. But I can't find any actual evidence for any of that at all. I just think it's a nice story, you know?
Mm.
And Penelope had her own new career in sorting out her whole family's inheritance and providing for her children's upbringing. And she was then in another relationship with more children. There was an awful lot of children, by the way. I was starting to run out of ways of dealing with yet another childbirth in the book, because it's not so easy to make sure that it's not repetitive, you know?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The truth is that it was a repetitive business for an Elizabethan lady that was having a child nearly every year. Of course, there are various reasons, but one of them was high infant mortality and stillbirths, and those make it very complicated to track everything.
Yes.
But Penelope was also embroiled in legal action by people that were trying to defame her, and she was defending her name and all that kind of thing. So I tried to find a path in the book, in the narrative, that gives a flavour of what that might have been like without making it too much like a court-based novel.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So moving on towards the end, how did Penelope become a lady of the bedchamber to Queen Anne, Tony?
Well, her strategy worked is the short answer, because she was already known to King James. And, of course, Anne of Denmark was a very well-educated... She's a fascinating lady as well. The more I found out about her, I could almost find a whole book about her, really.
I was going to ask, is there one coming?
And what she needed was, she had her Scottish ladies in waiting, so she was determined that they would come down en masse to England when King James said the time was right.
Yes.
And she would have her own court, which would be like chalk and cheese to Elizabeth's court, because she was... it's very different when you're the queen to a reigning king, isn't it? But what she needed was people who could advise her on who to trust and who not to trust and what to say and do and what had happened in the past and what that meant. And Penelope was perfect for that. So they had a kind of symbiotic relationship because they needed each other. And Penelope had been thinking about this ever since the Essex Rebellion, really.
Yeah. She was a clever lady.
Very much so. Mm. And it was a high risk strategy, because she could have been thrown in the tower. People like Robert Cecil had their own spy network, because he effectively took over from Francis Walsingham,
yes,
as the spy master, and he actually had intercepted copies of Penelope's letters to King James, which would have been enough to have her thrown in the tower if the Queen was to learn of it. But of course, there's an important detail here that Robert Cecil was also mindful of his own position after the Queen's days. So if he made an enemy of Penelope, then what might that mean for him if and when King James is on the throne?
So highly political.
Oh, very much so. Mm. And it's you can see echoes of it today when there's an election coming up. People start positioning themselves in quite risky ways, don't they?
They do, yeah. What do you think Penelope's legacy is?
It's through her children, because she invested everything in her children, and in different ways they continued to influence history, because two of her sons fought in the civil wars,
yeah,
and her daughter Elizabeth, with all of them in different ways, had influence at court. Yeah, so as well as Penelope influencing things at court, even after her days, her children continued to be very closely associated with the king and queen.
Penelope's story takes us past the end of the Tudors with the death of Elizabeth. So what are you planning to write next, Tony?
I'm actually currently researching the second of the three ladies, which is the fifth book in the Elizabethan series.
Okay.
And I'm really enjoying doing that, because what I'm doing is building layer upon layer of previous years of research. So just as with Penelope, I'd already studied the life of her brother and seen Penelope through his eyes. I'm now continuing that theme with somebody else and looking at events, like I mentioned, the Spanish Armada, from a completely different perspective, which what you get then is a kind of multidimensional view of the Elizabethan period, which I never could have achieved if I'd set out to write a book with Queen Elizabeth as a central character.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? Because obviously from an academic point of view, you would particularly, you know, when you're younger and you're at school, you probably use one or two history books, and that defines your sort of perception of what happened.
Oh, absolutely.
Forever, doesn't it?
I find it quite shocking. When they invent time travel, I'm going to go back to my history lessons and stick my hand up and say, "Can I stop you there, sir?"
Yeah.
He won't thank me for it.
No.
But we briskly went through the six wives of Henry VIII, then moved on to Elizabeth,
yes,
like as if nothing much happened in between.
Yeah.
And, of course, a huge amount happened in between, of great consequence, socially, politically, economically. And I was going to say, unfortunately for me, we kind of just breezed through that following a curriculum. But actually, I'm not sorry, because I've quite enjoyed discovering it all fresh in later life.
Yeah, and I guess the idea is to give you an overview of it, and you wouldn't possibly have your time at school to go through extensive research, yes, that you've done. So it does sort of light your fire a little bit, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
For later.
Yeah.
And so where can people find out more about your work, Tony, and where can they obtain your books?
Well, it's easy, because if you just type in Tony Riches in Amazon, all my books pop up. Penelope's doing jolly well, by the way.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
She was a hot new release on Amazon US, which, considering the competition, is something I'm quite pleased with, and I'm certainly encouraged by it.
Yeah.
And she's currently hovering around the top 20 in a couple of categories in the US and the top 10 in some categories in the UK.
Oh, that's excellent.
Amazon's algorithm's quite interesting now, because it changes, it seems, kind of randomly. It doesn't like update every day like it used to. So you can go in and she could be number 5, and then you go in 10 minutes later and she's number 4 or number 8.
Yes.
Because other people discount their books to 99 pence and things, which I don't do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So it's a little job every morning, is it? You just sort of see what number you are in the charts.
I used to. I do it kind of every now and then.
Yeah.
If I seem to have sold a lot of books in one day, which can happen, then I go in and see how that's rippled through. But if I'm perfectly honest, it's not just about the sales. It's the personal satisfaction of knowing that I've done something to make people aware of Penelope and her life and to want to find out more.
And what sort of feedback do you get from your readers, Tony?
Oh, it's really great to have. I'm active on most social media, and I get quite a few little things through my website where people have said they'd never heard of her, but they've really enjoyed reading the book or something like that. And sometimes they come out with questions like, I believe that I'm directly descended from Anne Boleyn. Could you help me to prove this? And things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it kind of goes with the territory, doesn't it?
It does. And I have to say, I think that little story you told me just before we went on air about the mother who had thanked you for helping child. That, could you just tell us a bit about that? Because that's a lovely story.
Yeah, that a lady in Connecticut got in touch with me and said that I'd reignited her teenage son's interest in history, and that he was devouring all of my books and doing jolly well in history at his high school now. And that's more satisfying than seeing a sudden spike in book sales, really, because it's the other side of the world, and to think that people are taking an interest in British history to that level of detail is quite encouraging.
Yeah, it is. It sounds fantastic. Well, Tony, I found this conversation really interesting. The Tudor period was a fascinating period, and I guess that's why it's so popular with readers. Political intrigue, treason, as well as a period of great change culturally and socially. Also, I think, and I know we were talking about this earlier, I think reading a novel which is based on facts is a great way of learning about history at the same time as enjoying the story. You don't have to be an academic. My guest today has been Tony Riches, best-selling author and specialist in the history of the early Tudors. And you can find out more about Tony on his website, along with his books, links of which are on the show notes. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to share the show link to your friends and family. And if you have 60 seconds, I will be most grateful if you would please rate and review. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the show and visit undercurrentstories.com. If you leave your email in the link, we will notify you as soon as new episodes are released. Also, check out our social media links, details of which can be found on the show notes. Until next time, this is Bob Wells wishing you all the very best.